DeCamp versus DeCamp. Mr. Emmer, I see Mr. Somerville also with us, and Mr. Muroff. It's hard for me to believe that either Mr. Emmer or Mr. Somerville are going to argue solo, so how are you going to split your time? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Emmer.
I think we have barely a moment to say good morning before it turns into the afternoon. I'm Steve Emmert, and along with George Somerville, we represent the husband in this appeal that involves primarily issues of spousal support. There are also issues of arbitrariness and attorney's fees, but that's the dominant issue in this appeal. The trial court made several specific findings in writing and orally in the record, and then proceeded to disregard them when it came to applying the law to those. For example, the court made a finding that the wife failed to segregate her own expenses from those of the children in asking for support. There's a specific finding to that effect on pages 1774 and 1782, but then the court gave her spousal support anyway, based upon the consolidated figure. Similarly, the court found that the wife is able to work repeatedly.
Well, Mr. Emmer, let me interrupt you. Let's talk about that for just a second. As I read, first of all, there's no question that there's an obligation to segregate to some extent. Now, Robbins, I think, also, albeit in dicta, Robbins also recognizes that there's some expenses that are just impossible to segregate. I mean, you don't parse out what the electric bill is, you know, spouse versus the kids, or the internet bill, or food, and that sort of thing.
It's also an exclusion for de minimis expenses.
And in this case, there were a number of expense statements submitted, but the final one, I think, which is what the court ultimately must have relied on, at least inferentially, if nothing else, shows no expenses under the children's expenses category, and the evidence in the record, in the light most favorable to Mr. Muroff, who prevailed below, is the wife responded, doing this income and expense statement, I was advised by counsel that those are children's expenses and not my expenses, so they should not be included. So inferentially, that suggests that there are no unsegregated expenses in that particular exhibit.
I think you're referring to the portion that we identified.
303, I guess.
Exactly. In the reply brief, we addressed that on page 2, where the exhibit that we're talking about had two separate sides, the left-hand and the right-hand side. And they were specifically talking about the right-hand side. But in the left-hand side, which is where the expenses were listed, clearly her expenses were amalgamated with those of the children. And the trial court specifically found that there was no segregation. I really don't have to go beyond that because there's been no assignment of cross error to that specific finding by the trial court. So while there may be some plausible basis in the evidence to say she at least attempted to do so, the trial court made a finding that she did not succeed in doing so. And on appeal, I think we're bound by that since there's no assignment of cross error. I'll turn briefly to the issue of the wife's ability to work and market her residual employment capacity.
Now, on that point, trial court puts you in a sort of bad position.
Absolutely.
Says, yeah, we won't let you update, and since you haven't updated, you lose. If I understand correctly what the trial court, the basis for that trial court's ruling was, y'all had violated the discovery order. Is that correct?
I think that was the origin of his ruling because the discovery order called for presentation of evidence 15 days before trial.
Yeah.
And the trial convened in two different stages. Originally, it was one two-day period in September. And then when the wife's case was going to take the full 2 days, they had to convene again 15 or 5 weeks later.
Well, the trial court puts you in an awful position.
Indeed.
And this is with Judge Pro Tem.
Indeed, for that too. Yes, exactly. That was a difficult position because on cross-examination, the expert who had prepared this list back in probably August, yeah, was forced to acknowledge, no, I don't know if they're available now because I'm not allowed to update it. And that's part of the problem in discounting Mr.
Well, Mr. Emmer, let me see if I can get a handle on this issue, because I think the law is pretty clear that in terms of imputation of income, there's some flexibility there on the part of the trial court. Spouses are not expected to immediately, especially if they haven't worked, you know, in many, many years during the marriage, to, as soon as the divorce papers are filed, to run out and find employment.
I agree.
This particular individual has some physical issues that are in play as well. Now, So in terms of the abuse of discretion standard that applies to this particular issue on appeal, I guess my question would be, you know, in addition to the issue of the discovery, compliance with the discovery order, in essence, every time an expert testifies along these lines, you're taking a snapshot, if you will, of what the employment market is at a given point in time.
I agree.
And it seems to me that given the discovery, both the rules and the order that apply to this particular case, that snapshot is whatever the court sets as the point at which the evidence is exchanged between the parties. And
Bear, that's for a second. I want to make sure I understand. You're talking then about a time in August before the trial of the first. Okay.
Whenever, I'm just speaking generally, but and I'll get to this particular case in just a second. So we've got this expert who has prepared his testimony regarding whatever it is he's going to say. Now, what the proffer was that there were, I think it was, if I recall correctly, about 8 jobs available that, in his opinion, would have fit this particular individual's skill set. And then later, when the evidence was when he actually testified some days later, he testified that none of those he wasn't sure if any of those jobs were still available.
Agreed.
And the trial court found that was unpersuasive, at least to that extent. And you allege that's error, essentially.
Correct.
And I'm trying to get a handle on where the error occurred, because it seems to me we're stuck with what the experts proffer was, and the expert could have hypothetically testified that given a particular skill set and looking at the market over a period of time, X number of jobs that in my opinion would be fitting for this particular individual come available in the course of a year or whatever it is. That wasn't the testimony. The testimony was, on this particular day, there's 8 jobs available. On this other particular day, there might be more jobs available, but that wasn't disallowed. You allege improperly. What we're stuck with in the record is 8 jobs were available, but they're not necessarily available right now. And so I guess my question is, setting aside the discovery issue, because I think that's kind of a separate issue, where is the error in terms of abuse of discretion in concluding that the testimony, there were 8 jobs, but they're not, I don't know if they're still available, is error for the court to not consider?
I'm going to have a difficult time dissecting those two rulings because they're interrelated. I should also mention, before I forget it, that the record is a little more forgiving on our side than what you've represented, because the testimony was that there is a rising demand for nurses. They're always going to be increasing over this time. So when he said he initially prepared the report, I would say in late August, and submitted it 15 days before trial. And then by the time he testified, it was late October. Now, again, the court has the testimony that's unchallenged in here that there was a rising demand for nurses. They have the testimony that he had that those jobs were available back in August when he prepared his report and would have been available at the time if the case had been tried in a unitary function. But since the court told the parties, I'm going to treat this as though it was all tried together, The husband in this case was left with the idea of, I'll just tell the judge what jobs were available back then, because the judge had promised this. I'll treat it as though it were tried together. And then when the letter opinion came out, he then chose to disregard them because the witness couldn't say that those jobs were available 2 months later, effectively disavowing his own promise on that. That's the problem. And the problem is one of admissibility of evidence, and I won't say admissibility because I think the evidence is already in, of the courts arbitrarily disregarding that evidence for a reason that I think we can probably agree.
Right, do we remand just for that specific point, or do we have to because this has dragged on for some time. And one of the things that at least I'm trying to be mindful is, it's one thing when ExxonMobil is fighting with, you know, Apple or whatever, you know, that have limitless resources, but, you know, I don't think the wife does, and... So would it be a remand just for evidence on the job situation, or do we have to reopen the whole thing?
Well, I think that there are more issues that we've appealed than just the job issue. For example,
that's the
biggest issue by far. If the court were to impute the roughly five,
and if I could just follow up on that, because I think you could answer two questions at once, maybe.
Happy to do that.
clearly at some point. If she's able to work, I mean, a petition for a modification based on change of circumstances would be appropriate. And especially, it seems to me, in the light of an expanding job market, there may come a tipping point when, based on the passage of time and the availability of positions, it makes more sense to impute income. That option is certainly available, is it not?
It is. But what I have in my favor is a specific written finding that the wife is able to work now, and that the jobs, she can find a job. That's what specifically what he said. No question that Ms. DeCamp can find a position of employment. That's on page 2257. So it's not necessarily there's going to be a change of circumstance. The circumstance existed as of the date of the divorce. Now, I could go on gilding the lily here, but I propose to give the lectern to Mr. Murov at this point, if that's acceptable.
What about your expert witnesses?
Well, as far as Broughton was concerned, we've already talked about that. With regard to Hornsby, the court mm-hmm. gave a reason for disregarding him after having qualified him as an expert mm-hmm. and after having accepted his testimony over the objection of the wife. He then said, I'm going to disregard it, and gave what we have argued is an arbitrary and capricious reason. I'm not going to back off from that assertion at this point. Mm-hmm. He basically said, because the husband told me, I want you to find a house that was roughly within this range, which was what they had been living in up till then, the judge simply decided, I'm going to disregard it because the husband gave him the parameters. That's not a legitimate reason for doing so. I'll step aside now if that's acceptable.
You're off.
May it please the court. Good afternoon.
The big game is on.
This is a 21-year, 8-month marriage, Your Honors. The wife in this particular case, by agreement of the parties, was an at-home mother. The husband pursued a military career, even though he had great inherited wealth. During his military career, they moved 8 times.
Well, why don't you address the issues rather than give us a history of the marriage?
On the expense issue related to the children, the Robbins case is distinguished from the case before the court this afternoon. In the Robbins case, there was an absolute admission that the children's expenses were included in her expense statement. She admitted that her grocery line included food for herself. She testified that the auto insurance covered a cost for a vehicle for an emancipated child. Under the health expenses, it included expenses for a minor child. And the child court absolutely, and Judge Humphreys, I think, was on the Robbins panel. Judge Kelsey wrote the decision. But the trial court, I think, made a mistake in that case because they just did this mathematical exercise where they deducted the guideline amount of child support from the so-called stated need and came up with the remainder as the amount of the spousal support. That is an abuse of the statutory scheme. In this particular case, the court, in its 55-page decision, about 25 pages of which, 20 to 25 pages, are devoted to the spousal support issue, meticulously followed the statutory scheme. And I take exception, respectfully, with counsel when he says the court didn't parse out or didn't segregate the expenses. There is commentary in the judge's written opinion regarding the reduction and discounting of certain expenses of the wife. He actually completely disregarded several expenses, and he even made a comment about the food expenses, including, apparently in his opinion, including some amount for the children. So the court considered this factor. Plus, in the Vannetta case, and this is a very important case that I cited. It's an unpublished opinion, but I think the facts are somewhat similar and important. In the Vannetta case, the significance there is the court emphasized you just don't look at the math on the needs. It's the total statutory scheme. It's all of the factors that you consider. Standard of living, the length of the marriage, the role that the wife played in the home relative to the care of the children. You look at all of those statutory factors. You don't look at the needs in a vacuum in and of itself. I'm going to move on to the imputation of income. Judge Humphreys and Judge Haley, your fingerprints are all over the McKee case. They were very much involved. I would note for the court that the date, and this is an interesting point that I picked up this morning. I guess you read this stuff 100 times and you look at something the 100th time differently than you did the other 99 times. The date of the separation in the McKee case was April of 2004, and the evidentiary hearing was November of 2005. The date of the separation in the DeCamp case was February of 2012. The evidentiary hearing was in September and October of 2013. Both of them are precisely 1 year and 7 months after the date of the separation. One of the cornerstones of the McKee opinion is, when do you have to start going back to work? How soon? And I find it interesting that the length of time from the date of the separation to the date of the evidentiary hearing is precisely the same. The second thing that has not been addressed is that on the issue of the jobs, Mrs. DeCamp testified that she went and tried to look at all eight of the jobs. She did her due diligence before the trial began in September, and she testified that she was unable to get employment with all eight of the stated jobs that the expert testified to. On the September 26 report that seems to be in great dispute,
there's this factual finding by the trial court that she is able to find employment.
But I think the duty of the husband is to show what earning capacity is and to march that, respectfully, Your Honor, with specific jobs. And they're complaining about this September 26 report not getting in. The court's already noted it's a clear violation of the pretrial order, which a court speaks through its orders. We all know that.
And the fact that she can find a job, this is going to have to be a distinctive type of nursing job because of the constraints that she faces due to her health.
Yes. And I think one of the strengths of the judge's decision, Your Honor, is the point you just made. And this is the point the trial court made in the McKee case. Mrs. McKee, Mrs. DeCamp, I'm not saying that you never will have to work. I think both of those courts put that out there, that's something that's going to have to be addressed. I don't know how we go beyond the testimony of Mr. Broughton when he says none of these are readily available. The September 26 report was not proffered. So how can we complain about something today when we don't know what the substance of the September 26 report would have been?
Well, wasn't the husband sandbagged here? I mean, how, you know, if you have a duty to talk about jobs today, all right, and you have this continuance in the trial, if you have to testify as to jobs today, why couldn't they bring it up to date, if you will? I mean, what else could they have done,
Your Honor,
to meet a standard? You got to tell us what jobs are available today.
What
could they have done?
I go back to the discovery order, which apparently the court may not be quite as impressed with as I am, okay? But I would also point to you, Your Honor, how can we speculate as to what Mr. Broughton's testimony would have been about the September 26 jobs when it wasn't proffered? That is a time...
It's not in the record. We just don't know what it is.
Right. That's a time-honored principle of review by an appellate court. We have to put in front of your honors what the testimony would have been so you can vet out the quality and persuasiveness of the testimony.
Well, we know this, though, that the testimony is going to be about the current job market. We know that, don't we?
I would assume it is, Your Honor, yes.
Well, hypothetically, let me follow up on that. Hypothetically, this wasn't the case, but it seems to me we'd have a different situation here had the expert testified that 2 months earlier, when I was ready to testify, there were eight jobs available that, in my expert opinion, the wife could perform or could secure that were within her physical capacity. Those eight jobs are not available, or at least I don't know if they're available now, but based on my expert opinion in reviewing the market, these jobs come available on a regular basis and over the course of, you know, in fact, in the last 2 months, had somebody bothered to check, those jobs are no longer available, which suggests that at least in 2 months, eight people got hired for those jobs. So, and then that would have been within the limits of the discovery order, and the fact finder could have drawn reasonable inferences if they had chosen to from that. Could they not have?
Yes, Your Honor. And another recourse that husband had, if you look at the pretrial order, he can make a motion to the court to amend the time frames in the pretrial order, and he could have said, you know, based on my search, I'm not sure that these eight are readily available. I'm asking for, he could have done this before the September 11th trial began. I'm asking for leave to supplement the report. And I venture to say the way that the judge handled this trial, that would have probably been granted, but he didn't do it. It was within his fingertips. He could have done it, but he didn't, just like he didn't proffer the September 26th report. On the issue, Your Honor, of Mr. Hornsby, you know, he was accepted as an expert, but I'm really not sure what he was accepted for. So he knows a lot about the cost of houses in Williamsburg. Fine. But he was presented based on what is suitable housing for the standard of living for Mrs. DeCamp during the marriage.
Is that ultimately a legal question for the trial court?
I think that's the province of the
legal
court.
Legal or factual?
Right. Yeah. On the attorney's fees issue, which hadn't been addressed, I really outlined in some detail how husband put wife to the mill. You know, he had this generation skipping trust of $5 million, and he complained about that reducing his income. He appealed that, or noted, preserved his appeal. He abandoned that. He had all these kind of off the wall experts about different issues regarding her expenses, discounted. She had to prepare to defend that. There was the one of the factors in 107.1, the scheme, is the monetary and non-monetary contributions, or the second, and the circumstances of the dissolution of the marriage. We have some letters from him about mea culpa, I'm a miser, I'm very difficult. And all of this made this a high conflict case. How often do you see a four-day spousal support trial? They settled ED beforehand. This man had $31,000 a month in gross income, a net worth when you impute the assets back to him of over $10 million. He's living in a $1 million house, and that standard of living was the last 6 years of the marriage. And maybe they were only married 21 years and 8 months, but the last 6 years they were living in a mansion in Williamsburg, and that's something that cannot be discounted. We hope that when you consider all of these factors, the court was very meticulous in its tracking the statutory scheme. It criticized Mrs. DeCamp's credibility. The judge was not one-sided in this case. He weighed every factor he could possibly weigh. Another point on the attorney's fees was he wouldn't even agree to designate her as the beneficiary of his survivor annuity of the military retirement, and he didn't want to give her 50% of the marital share, and he didn't want to give her any spousal support. What choice did she have? That's all on the record. You have to defend that position when you take these types of extreme positions, and that's what drove a $50,000 award of attorney's fees in this case, which is a high award of attorney's fees.
And I don't think it's so much the amount that's at issue as if, as I understand the argument, if husband prevails in some of these issues, well, then that would have to be revisited, which makes sense, but
That is certainly within the purview of you, gentlemen, and I trust that you will consider affirming the trial court's decision across the board. We think it was a thoughtful decision and well written. Thank you.
Mr. Emmer.
I'll address the arguments that Mr. Mirov has made somewhat in order, at least the ones that I think need reply. I'm not going to replow the ground that we've already got in briefs or already argued. He makes some arguments with regard to segregation of expenses that are foreclosed by the law of the case doctrine because there's no assignment of cross error to the trial court's specific finding. The same problem exists with regard to the specific finding about her ability to find work and find it now. He correctly points out that the parties separated in February 2013, and the wife left the marital residence 11 months later in February 2012, and the wife left the marital residence in January 2013. I've cited some pages in the appendix where that's found, but I failed to realize that the simple way to do it is pages 4 and 8 of the appendix. They stipulated to those dates. And that's the point at which we believe she's on notice that she's going to have to start getting a job or training herself for a job. Instead, as we've quoted, and the judge noted that as well, she was busy getting a divorce and could not be put to the trouble of improving her marketing or marketing her.
Is there a bright line? Are you suggesting there's some sort of a bright line date by which you need to start looking for work. I mean, it seems to me the jurisprudence is fairly flexible in that regard.
I agree that it's flexible, and I don't think that it's something that this court should undertake to decree that the trial court must do, but it has to be earlier than never, which is what it is now. If the parties separated with the intention of remaining separated permanently in February 2012, and here we are in late 2014, and the wife is still voluntarily employed. Something like that. That ended poorly, though. I don't want to go there. With regard to the idea about the mansion in Williamsburg, you may recall that the trial court at pages 1774 and 75 noted, and again, this isn't objected to, that for the majority of the marriage, the parties' living arrangements were quite modest because of their military issue. If he's looking for a mansion in Williamsburg or elsewhere, then that's not consistent with what the trial court found was the dominant type of living arrangement they had during the marriage. Finally, with regard to the pretrial scheduling order, we complied with the pretrial scheduling order by giving them the information 3 weeks before the reconvened trial. What the trial judge did was say, no, we're going to backdate it to August. But he gave us a specific promise, and it's at page 504 of the appendix, to say, I'll treat it as though it were tried altogether.
And that seemed a little odd, but is the proffer sufficient? Do we have enough to know testimony was going to be?
I don't think you have enough to know what the testimony would be about future jobs. I will agree with that, because we were basically told by the judge we're going to treat it as though this was all occurring in September. And under those circumstances, the judge gave us that indication and then backed off on it when he issued the letter opinion.
Isn't there still a duty of adequate proffer?
Well, there's a duty to proffer if you're relying upon the future jobs, and I would agree to that. But the point is, we were put in a position where we were told this is how the case is going to be tried. And then the case wasn't tried that way through no fault of the trial lawyer in this case. That's not the way these cases should be tried. Under these circumstances, the appropriate thing for the court to do is to remand this case to the trial court with a direction to reconsider the issue of spousal support, specifically to direct the imputation of income at some point, but at some point now in the past, because we're well past the point at which this wife should have been in a position to get income. I also request a remand for the purposes of attorney's fees, as you've seen. I appreciate your interest in the issues of this case and for your courtesy to me today.
Thank you. We'll come down to Greek Council and take up the last case.